Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the lovely Julia Bainbridge, food editor at Yahoo Food. So I want to preface and thank everybody. This is episode 200.
Woo-woo!
Wow, and it's taken me 200 episodes to realize that we have sound effects. I don't know why those aren't intermixed within every show.
I hide them for special occasions.
From now on. But thank you, everybody here at Heritage, for making this. It wasn't even a dream. I didn't even think I would ever be doing this once, yet alone for over 4 years. But it's been a wonderful
ride. What are you
going
to do to celebrate?
Have you on the show.
Oh,
that's what
oh,
I was
do we
hoping
have a drink
for.
Too?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Do you have a. I've already popped a bottle of champagne in here a few episodes ago, so. That was a celebration in and of itself.
Right on. Congrats.
Thank you so much for being on. You are not only a wonderful editor, writer, but a dear friend. And it's been very interesting and eye-opening to know you and know food at the same time, because your sense of style and fashion and the way you set a scene, you know, whether it be visually or you know, on the page or on a website is unlike any other that I've seen.
Oh, God.
You have such swagger.
You say that's
to
all
you.
The girls?
No. You can go 200 episodes in archives and see that I don't. But
well,
it started somewhere. And the first thing I ask of you is I want to see your Natty Bow face. Can you do a Natty Bow face?
Oh, my gosh. I don't even know what that you mean, like of the guy on the Natty Bow.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you do the face?
I can do a face of what I look like after many Natty Bows.
I forget we're radio too, and no one else can actually see this. So I'm going to say that was an excellent Natty Bow face you just pulled.
Thank you.
Tremendous.
Thank you.
But
years of work.
Growing up in Maryland, were you in Baltimore proper or?
Yes. Well, I sort of am like half and half city and country girl. So I grew up in Roland Park, which is like technically within the city. And then half of me was out with my grandparents on the horse farm. So. I'm country a little bit, but
horses
yeah,
and lacrosse is what you told me before the show.
Yeah, I know. They always said, what was it, that movie that said, like, crab cakes and football, the Wedding Crashers? That is not Maryland in my experience.
Really?
Are there
crab cakes?
No, there are definitely crab cakes, but the football part, I mean, lacrosse is really a thing. Lacrosse in Maryland's like football in Texas. It's a religion.
So with that Native American thing going on, are there other Native American food traditions, like pemmican, and I only know that because I'm a jerky addict right now.
No. Just no, not
absolutely none.
Not that I'm aware of.
Crabs, crab cakes, pit beef. This was part of your life as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, that ties into lacrosse. Pit beef was just something that, was at every game. I mean, that was tailgate food. I don't know exactly how it's all prepared. I know it's a big hunk of, some rounds, you know, eye rounds, and really slathered in a dry rub that, you know, seeps its way into the center over many hours, and then it's seared and cooked low and slow. And then it's the things I do know and I feel passionate about regarding pit beef are in the condiments or lack thereof. So, you know, it's the beef on a Kaiser roll, raw onions, and either mayo or like a horseradish sauce, and that's it.
It's kind of like the idea of Old Bay seasoning. Like, there's that and nothing else.
Right, right.
And Old Bay
is... Why, you want to talk about crabs?
Yeah, let's talk about crabs. I mean, Old Bay seasoning is a Baltimore or Maryland staple.
Yeah.
And I know I've shipped it internationally to chefs who are like, oh, can you send me some of that Old Bay? Like, it's crack. Like, it's like,
yeah, totally. I mean, now you can find it elsewhere. It's so funny. I remember years ago bringing Old Bay to, like, a boyfriend's father as a host gift who lived in Connecticut, and I thought it was something really special, and later I learned, like, he'd just get it at his grocery store. So I think that's good for Maryland. Old Bay is, you know, making the rounds. But I mean, all I'll say about crabs, because, you know, I don't want to be the Maryland girl who talked about crabs the whole time, but steamed, not boiled, slathered in Old Bay, steamed over a mixture of water, beer, and vinegar. There should be enough Old Bay that if it seeps into any, like, paper cut on your lip or fingers that may come from, you know, taking the thing apart, it should sting.
Cauterizing sting.
Yes, yes. And that's pretty much it. Oh, I say eat as you go, although I remember growing up, my brother's friend had this really funny sort of like dangling it in front of your nose, sort of a hoarder mentality, maybe. I don't know. He would pick through all the crabs. You know, you're sitting around a round table or whatever, and there's newspaper down, and you've got beer, and your hands are just covered in it. That's the experience, right? He'd pick through all the crabs, which takes a lot of work, leaving this pile in front of him that he would then eat all at once at the end. You know, so we were left, like, salivating when we had picked, you know, been eating as
that,
we go
that
and
doesn't
picking
feel
through.
Like a shared experience.
That it doesn't. I should see where he is now. What is it, a profession that set him up for?
See how that style of eating has equated into his everyday life. Yeah. He's actually a hoarder.
Right.
So just watch that show and maybe he'll pop
up.
Well,
then all the meat's cold, too, by that time. So.
No, you got to slurp with the others.
Yeah. Chris, incorrect, wherever you are.
Growing up, you weren't the cook of your family. Your parents, not even so much, but your grandmother. Tell me what kind of cook she was and what she used to make.
Yeah, well, in my mother's defense, she did cook every day. There, you know, we were a family of six. There were four kids within 6 years. You know, so at one point, it's like she's got four kids all under the age of six. That's, you know, a lot. And we sat down and had dinner together every night. So while Ann Bainbridge, I'm sorry, it wasn't always great. It was home cooked, and we had that sense of community around the table and conversation, and so that has definitely influenced me. It's funny now that we're all out of the house. She's become a great cook because it's not a chore anymore and she's having fun with it.
She's only cooking for a few rather than
Yeah. I mean, she's a great baker. She experiments. I get little photo updates of chowder she's made. It's like, why now, Mom? Why now? but yes, my grandmother, who is from Virginia, was the great cook. And so in a way, you know, although... where I grew up is technically below the Mason-Dixon line. I don't consider myself from the South, but I did kind of have a little bit of that Southern culture from my grandmother, who would make things like fried green tomatoes and, you know, biscuits and Virginia ham and things like that. But it's, you know, pecan pie. She made a really good pecan pie. And I think, you know, it's funny how your perception changes, right? You may have experienced this too. Like, growing up, I think compared to my mom, I thought, and because, I don't know, we all amped my grandmother up. It was like she was the best. She, you know, had this old school way of cooking and, you know, sort of this rootsy way of cooking. And now that this has become my profession and I have a culinary degree, I come back to it and realize, like, it actually wasn't all that great, you know, and actually, like, I've surpassed her in terms of skill level, but I guess in the end, that isn't the point. And I think that's not the point of I mean, sure, I like eating good food, but it's more, as cheesy as it sounds, about, you know, the shared experience and feeding your friends, sort of filling their bellies, making them happy. I mean, an example of that is I go to my grandparents' house. They're both still alive and in their mid-90s and rocking out. And they have a happy hour every evening these days at around 5. And they make old fashions for themselves. And they are shit. I mean, they make my grandfather, I think, just because it's called Virginia Gentleman, makes his old fashioned with Virginia Gentleman whiskey, which is the crappiest stuff in my opinion. And it's all wrong. The ratios are out of whack because, you know, their taste buds aren't as sharp as they once were. But I mean, it really doesn't matter. It's like, oh, this lovely experience we all have together. And I love that they take the time to still concoct, you know, I mean, a cocktail isn't just pouring something, you know, wine from a bottle into a glass. There's some ceremony around it. There are, you know, there's a squeezing of a lemon, or, you know, and it's sort of this little presentation and ceremony that they enjoy every day. So I'm looking forward to my mid-90s, man.
Yeah.
All fashions every day.
Jeez, they're just called fashions at that point. You're already old enough.
True.
But I want to kind of like take that idea of ceremony and talk about your background in anthropology, because you went to school, you know, and that's the studying of other cultures through many different lenses and, you know, from, you know, different sciences, from, you know, so many outside influences. And that's informed you, especially just talking about, you know, old fashions and the way of ceremony.
Right.
You know, that's not how food was talked about even 10 years ago.
Right.
Like, there wasn't that much. There were food writers out there, obviously. But Sidney Mintz, tell me about this fella and how that person influenced you.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what planted the seed. Like, it was in college studying anthropology, and then I found out about food anthropology. I found people studying other cultures through their food ways, through what they eat, through what they don't eat, through what taboos there are, you know? I just found that super interesting. That's obviously not what I'm doing now. I'm not.
It informs what you're doing
but
now.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it informs what I do in the sense that I really like the weird little corners of the food world and finding, you know, these tiny little angles, sort of that really unique color in the prism of a story that everybody is covering, and finding this weird way to cover it. And the same thing Sydney, my old pal Cindy, Sydney, did, you know, studying a single food or commodity such as sugar, you know, doing an analysis of a history of a single commodity, and sort of prying open the history of the entire world and social relationships and human behavior around that. So, again, I'm no academe, but this did plant the seed for sort of going specific and deep into things about food.
Yeah, but
beyond the food itself, because honestly, sometimes I don't know, apologies, but I get a little sick of talking about food sometimes, about food just as
food. Agreed. You know, I live kind of on the subsidiary as well.
Yeah.
That I think the food scene's about, you know, a lot of the cogs of the industry rather than the industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily about the trends, but about, you know, those that understand how to interpret those trends.
Right.
Or have influenced those trends priorly. And, you know, having a background in anthropology, having that kind of foundation is kind of like going to culinary school before you cook.
Right.
You know, and you're able to talk about something so singularly and in such depth because you understand it in this greater scope, or, you know, with so much more depth than most would. So it's not your best burger list.
Right. I mean, the same thing to just share another writer's name in case people want to look into this stuff. Margaret Visser, her book Much Depends on Dinner was another book that really influenced me, because she takes sort of an ordinary American meal, I guess, at the time. It consisted of corn, salt, butter, chicken, rice, and lettuce. And she goes course by course. You know, each chapter is one of those food items. And she goes into the history and mythology and taboos behind those things. So it's 300 pages on nine food items.
Yeah.
But super interesting, because it goes beyond, obviously, the food item itself.
I mean, with Yahoo Food, how many items are up at the page? Well, it's an infinite scrolling number of things up on Yahoo Food.
Yeah.
So you get to kind of, you know, pique your interest in whatever you want to do every single day.
Yeah. I mean, of course, we have a certain reader in mind who we're trying to serve. But I think what's really unique about what we're doing at Yahoo Food is that we do have these content partnerships, and we also do have these, you know, great food editors in-house. And so we're producing our own content, and then we're also kind of cherry-picking the best stories from other, you know, food media brands out there.
Bon App, Food & Wine, Martha Stewart.
Yeah, and we judged that list when we came in. I mean, this was a whole new you know, relatively new initiative, all these kind of new magazine verticals at Yahoo Food. And we launched in January, and we sort of weed whacked the pre-existing list of content partners, and now have found ones that we feel like really fit what we're trying to do. And the idea is that we are sort of scanning everything and giving the best to you, including our own stories. And it's sort of like a one-stop shop for a certain kind of person for the food news of the day.
It's great, though, because it's not aggregate where a lot of sites have been in the past. It's like added aggregate because there is, like you said,
we're curating it.
Yeah. And but there's new content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's in-house content. It's kind of like going to a restaurant these days and expecting homemade and house-made things.
Mm-hmm.
It almost should happen that in food media as well. You can't just cobble together the best of the best. You have to personally make something that's of that ilk as well.
Right.
That's what seemingly you guys are doing at the moment.
Hopefully. So, yeah, it's a work in progress.
I've been enjoying it because it kind of runs the breadth of ideas too, from, you know, design to, you know, singular ingredient to fashion to trends to, I mean, it's endless.
And yeah. That's what I think they did a smart job at, you know, we're a small team, but I think they hired people who are coming from different perspectives and hopefully, yeah, that shows that we balance each other out. So check it out.
We're going to take a quick break and come back to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
Happy 200.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. Here again today with Julia Bainbridge, food editor at Yahoo Food. And Jack, I must say, that was an amazing overvoice for the S. Wallace & Sons, you know, ham company, because I don't think you need to go to the website. All you need to know is pure white fat marbled. I mean, like,
oh, yeah.
What else do you need to know? Suriano is one of my favorite hams. Thank you again for sponsoring the show. Back to Yahoo Food.
Me too.
Yes. Yeah, Julia was a big fan even before she knew it was our sponsor. But back to Yahoo Food, because there's so much to cover. Again, it is this infinite scrolling list of just kind of amazing things. Very visual, giffy, you know, flashing in your face kind of things.
Some readers don't like that so much. We're sticking to it.
Yeah.
I think most people like it. I mean, I do like, you know, you go to the page and it kind of has that Pinteresty look of, you know, tiles. And hopefully that's working to entice people. I mean, you know, you come to the page and you see an image and a headline and you see that's really what you're seeing at the front door. And so hopefully that lures you to click into one place or the other. And I think the GIFs being able to move in line, you know, on the homepage like that, hopefully are entertaining. I think it makes the page look alive, but I realize it can also be a little stress-inducing. So.
Only for the epileptic, it's fine. Every day there's something new. And recently, I think this past weekend, you threw a party at your house. Tell me about it.
About how it turned into something for Yahoo Food or just it?
The party itself and how it did turn into something, because it was kind of an amazing collection of people and ideas.
Well, thanks. Gosh, I mean, I think I'm lucky that I've been around for a little while now in New York and in this scene. And so I find that women especially, sorry, but, you know, this was a lady Sunday dinner party. And I find that women in New York, we're like constantly picking each other up. Like, I feel like I've picked up more chicks at bars than dudes because it's like, you just, I don't know, we're connectors. I'm always meeting people and they say, oh, I have this friend who, you know, does such and such and I think you'd be interested. And, you know, you meet a girl, another girl for a coffee and you sort of create all these helpful relationships. Anyway, this was sort of like an en masse lady connector supper, you know, and a lot of these women who I've met over the years who are interested in fashion, are interested in food, and, you know, who are successful and who are smart. And I just wanted to get them all. I mean, not all of them. It was a certain group of them, but in one place. And then Sunday supper is something I love to do because it starts at 5. In the winter months, it starts at 4. You come that early, you get sort of fat and happy and well-fed, have a few hours to hang out, and then you're back in your bed by 9 or so, 9 or 10, and you are, you know, that's a good start to the work week, I think, you know, so you're not out too late, and it sort of sets you, I guess that's the sort of mothering instinct in me, I don't know, and I threw it in conjunction with my friend Peyton. She and her husband have a wallpaper company called Flat Vernacular, and they've also launched another company called Department of Decoration, and they are doing little home decorating collections room by room, and they started with the dining room, and I'm really down with their designs because they're all about pattern and color. And while I love a Scandi situation, you know, I love me some burlap and some sort of creams on beige, I'm getting a little tired of it, and I really just want like some color. So we had, you know, every, you know, neon color under the sun sort of on the table with the food and with the decor. So it was just like a celebration of these people and of color and of good food. And that's about it. I don't think
Kimberly Hasselbrink.
Yes, Kimberly Hasselbrink. So her cookbook is called Vibrant Food, and that sort of fit the color theme perfectly, which wasn't meant to be a theme. It just sort of fell together that way. It happened that it was all about vibrant people, vibrant colors. And yeah, she's, man, it's like I found her, or we found her when I was at Bon Appetit years ago. And I think that at the time, this was kind of a labor of love. Like maybe she had a different day job and was kind of food blogging and taking photos. And then she's just, you know, now she does this full time. She has a cookbook. She's, you know, produces beautiful photographs that she gets paid to take professionally. I mean, she's just incredible and she has soared. So this is a great cookbook celebrating, you know, seasonal cooking. And I cooked from that.
Another wonderful thing that came out of that party and, you know, found itself on a Yahoo Food was a little tip for all hostesses about bare feet.
Yeah. With my stinking feet on there. Yes. Okay. So this is something from my grandmother that I took. She loves to be barefoot. And so do I. She cooks barefoot and so do I. And I do think, I do think there's a certain sort of, you indicate to your guests that there's a certain like nonchalance, there's a certain, you know, to be comfortable. It's sort of like the equivalent of letting your hair down, you know, so maybe your guests want to take their shoes off. Great. You know, I always like when people sort of drink a little too much, say a little too much, stay a little too long. And it just sort of seems to go along with that. Plus, honestly, you know, bare feet go with everything. Because there's no like color or shoe that might conflict with your dress, and dresses are very important to me. And you can be really stable on your feet. I mean, this is the reason why people are now running shoeless or running in those sort of like mock shoes, you know, because there's so many bones in your feet that exist to help support you. So I find that when I'm running back and forth from room to room and chopping things and searing things and filling wine glasses, I mean, it's more comfortable to be barefoot.
I agree. I even extended as far as I often cook shirtless, which my wife doesn't always like.
Because I haven't seen that at your house.
Well, she's always worried because I'm kind of a hairy guy.
Megan, don't be so conservative.
And there's oil and there's all these things, but
oh, so she's protecting you.
Yeah, more so than doesn't want to see it, I think.
Right, right.
But I also cook barefoot a decent amount of the time as well.
Don't you feel like the product is better that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We should do a side by side. We should really make it scientifically.
Barefoot versus shirtless.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yeah, that's Megan, I'm coming over.
That's a whole nother show. Yahoo Food also does a lot of current reported pieces. And, you know, gives props to the community, but also makes people aware of certain things. Like, you guys covered the Manresa fire, you know, in Los Gatos with its such sincerity. You know, that was, you know, just, it's so nice to see that sometimes within all this other crazy media that happens. But that, you're honorific of the industry as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, something like that. I mean, thank you for that. And, you know, I think we're trying, we wouldn't cover it straight because we're a national, you know, we have a national audience. And we also have an audience who, while they care about eating good food, they're not like chef fangirls. They're not, or, you know, or fan guys. They're not sort of as crazy about the industry as we editors are. So you have to take a story like that, and if you want to cover it, figure out a way to make it appeal. And so that was sort of an opportunity for us to talk about, here's really what a fire does to a restaurant. Here, you know, it's not just that you're out of work for a few days and you have to pay some, you know, rehab, you know, fees for the space. It's all the rest of it. You know, it's your employees aren't making money during that time. It's the farmers aren't making money because you're not paying them for onions during those however many weeks or days, you know. So it was a way to clue our readers in to how devastating something like that can be.
We're on the slightly lighter side of Verite. You also did a day in the life of Mission Cantina, a one-star restaurant review.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's the same kind of idea. It's like when you have a paper with such influence and, you know, reviewers with such who are such a big deal as the ones at the New York Times, when you get a one-star review, what does that mean for the restaurant? Like, how does that change how many people are calling in for the next couple of weeks? How does, you know, really look in a real way at how that affects the restaurant? That can be hard to get information, you know, to report on, of course, because the restaurant doesn't want to talk about it. Or, you know, I mean, in the case of the Manresa thing, it's like, I wanted to get an idea of numbers. You know, how much do you make in a day before versus now when you're not, you know, so how much are you not making? And that's hard information to get, of course, and it's sensitive information to ask for, but we try. I tried. And I think it was...
You and I got to collaborate on a piece about Mr. Softy.
Yes.
Where, again, it was very real life numbers, statistics, but meeting personalities and characters of people that frequent the truck, or for a few, it was their first time.
Yeah. I haven't yet gotten, we need to, after this, like, have the inside scoop on some of the characters you didn't include in that, but
there surely were some.
But yes, I mean, I think like Mr. Softy, or whether Mr. Softy is everywhere or not, everyone has an ice cream truck, right? So it's something everyone can relate to. It's, you know, all of the media is talking about ice cream right now because it's the summer. And so how can we capitalize on that trending topic in a way that's really touching, in a way that's entertaining? And that was having your wonderful photos of people from all walks of life. You know, you had kids, you had professors, you had, you know, a whole range of people who go there every day, people who it was their first time, just little snapshots into that sort of pleasure moment of their days. It's the great equalizer, we said, Mr. Softy Truck.
Let's actually talk about another equalizer. It's a series that you created, which is your first.
Oh, yes. So this is, you know, I think for our readers, they cook, but maybe aren't expert cooks, maybe aren't making the kinds of things that you, Michael, make at home. So this is sort of, it's
shirtless.
Shirtless, yeah. This is sort of your first go at a next level dish that might have otherwise intimidated you, but here's an easy, relatively easy recipe that will sort of hold your hand through that process. So that's whether it's like rolling sushi at home or making a yeasted dough bread, or a layer cake, which can be intimidating because, you know, you have this idea in your head that you have how perfect you want it to look, and it isn't always that way in practice. So they're kind of the 101 versions of each of these recipe types to open its arms to you, you know.
Another series is How Bad Is It Really? And before the episode, you asked me if I ever had deviled ham, and I thought it was one of those. I thought you were saying...
No, deviled ham is great. I bet the Suriana people would say the same thing.
Yeah, I've never had deviled ham.
Yeah, I don't... You know what? Honestly, I haven't looked at the ingredients, and I'm sure... It's sort of like Spam in the way that it's great, and you self-identify as the deviled ham eater, you know, and feel very proud of it, but I'm sure it's just... horrible stuff in there. But I mean, it's basically like cured ham blitzed up with more salt and something that makes it spreadable, and it's just like a ham spread.
Well, you talk about I think four things in How Bad Is It Really that I actually really like.
Oh yeah? Yeah, I can't remember.
I love Marmite.
Okay.
Love Marmite. I don't know, I was around a whole bunch of Australian, New Zealand rugby players when I was younger.
Right.
And they all ate Vegemite and Marmite and that kind of stuff. I actually really like cream caviar in a tube.
Me too.
I pretty much, when I travel, pick up as many condiments as possible. And the more toothpaste looking, the better.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, within that, people have their brands. Like, we tasted that Callus caviar. Mm-hmm. But then I talked to Andrew Knowlton, whose wife is... I forget where she's from exactly. But she grew up with that stuff. And supposedly that's like the plebe brand. So they have their favorite, and I forget what that is. I'm not being very helpful to you listeners, but
haggis,
which I love, but that's partly like the Scottish roots in me. But it's hard to get good haggis here, and there are all kinds of
you can't
regulations.
Actually get real haggis
here.
You can't
get real
haggis.
Have
lungs in haggis.
Right.
Lungs have been not USDA approved
since
1971.
It ends up being really like oily and fatty, and it doesn't have that sort of the real like... gamey, gutsy goodness.
Durian,
I mean, I no one's ever going to win this argument against me. I just think it's horrible, and I've never had it. I mean, it's like gasoline. It kind of tastes and smells like gasoline, and not in that good way. Like, you know how, I kind of like the smell of gasoline when you're at the, you know, filling up your car or whatever, but just not when you're thinking sweet, fresh melon. I don't know.
No.
Not something I want to
I worked
to
at a restaurant, and if you had to prep the durian, you had to go outside, and there was a table set up across the lot, which was only for durians. I mean, it wasn't even associated with the restaurant, it seemed.
Right.
But that's where you open up your durians.
Right.
But they're kind of exciting ornaments to have at the house until they split. And
right. So you're with me on
yes,
the durian camp.
I agree.
Right.
And natto, I'm not sure where I am yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it... Again, these, you know, we had a little panel and we tasted just once or twice. So there's definitely more different types and tasting to be had. My sister-in-law, who's Japanese, is a huge fan and eats it all the time. But a lot of these things, it's like, do you really like it or do you do it because it's a pride? You know,
well, I mean, like, I can do texture more than I can do flavor more often. So texture doesn't bother me. And natto, I don't feel like has a ton of, like, smell to it. Whereas you do something like stinky tofu... And it just, like, coats the inside of your nose in a way. And I have a little bit of stinky tofu here and there, and I try to eat more and more. But I'm realizing that there's no immunity to it. You either like it or you don't.
Right. Right. Not equalizers.
No.
Dividers.
Design, which is a very important part of your life. You were talking about flat vernacular before, and anyone that's been over to your house and in your bathroom knows how amazing that wallpaper is. But
amazing,
psychedelic. Also collected this list of wallpaper and restaurants of you know, horseshoe shaped bars. Like, how important is the aesthetic of setting a scene to you when it comes to food?
Yeah, very important. But I can't be that articulate about this. I just feel like, you know, other than my caring about how things look and my caring about the environment I'm in, honestly. And that comes to the plating of the food too. I mean, sometimes that's almost more fun to me than cooking it or eating it, is starting with that canvas of a blank plate and figuring out how to put things on there. And you can change it based on the moods, just like you can change your dress. You know, I could be one person one day and one person another, depending on the mask or the dress I'm wearing. You know what I mean? But I don't wear masks.
Yeah, I was about to.
I meant dresses as masks. I mean, not before 3 p.m. Yeah. anyway. But
let's go back to these plating tips, because yeah. I know you did a piece with Paul Kui of, or yeah. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Key, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, talk about somebody who's aesthetically, you know, driven. He's got kind of this mad genius brain. So, you know, sometimes you really have to interview him and get tips out of him. You really have to, like, keep driving away, because all of this is so natural to him. And he, you know, it's like to turn it into tips that are really servicey and useful for people takes a little bit of doing. But, man, he just creates beautiful, you know, beautiful little landscapes almost with his food. And he's really into age symmetry, which I am too. I find that more pleasing for no other reason than that. I just like how it looks better. So I'm trying to think of what other tips. Honestly, we post so blankness. Much that it like goes away yeah. from my yeah beauty in the blankness.
That's
yeah.
one of my favorite. You know, the use of negative
thank
space.
Thank you for telling me. What
being
I
a photographer,
wrote.
It's a very important thing as well.
Right.
You know, you learn the rule of thirds, and then you learn how to use negative space in this very striking way. But
right.
you can't just have a ton of negative space, and you have to be able to reinforce it with what you put in frame.
Right.
And that has to be as strong as the negative space.
Right.
So, but,
and he has a pretty singular aesthetic, at least with this restaurant. I mean, we'll see what he does in the future. But for me, the fun in plating is that you can do it differently depending on what you're feeling like and depending on what the food is. So whether you do that kind of minimal, asymmetrical plating with a lot of blank space, or you make a kind of beautiful mess, or you overload the plate, you know, with like a cornucopia of items or whatever. I mean, it's really fun to play around.
Take that cornucopia, go more myopic, and let's talk about these trends. Botarga and ancient grains. Both
oh,
recently
well,
mentioned on Yahoo Food as you know, go-to items.
Yeah, I mean, that's just... Yeah, I mean, I've just seen, you know, a lot of it. We do have a trend piece series called We're Seeing It Everywhere. And honestly, it's just because we're, you know, as editors, as people in this industry, we are out and about sort of sniffing and tasting what professionals are doing. And while I said our readers aren't particularly interested in, you know, chefs as people, they're interested in chefs as experts in their fields. And so certainly we do interview a lot of chefs for their tips on cooking. And one of those was Botarga. It's just like, you know, you may know about Botarga, but not all of our people do. So this was a way to introduce that to them, was this little video on how to use it. And I mean, talk about, I guess some people, that could have been a how bad is it really, maybe. A lot of
yeah.
people don't like that sort of funk.
But they're so willing to have caviar, yet not the cured roe sack
right.
of fish.
Right.
It's a funny, once removed kind of pantry item.
Yeah.
But I'm obsessed with Botarga.
Botarga, yeah.
Ancient grains like kamut.
Well, that, so, I mean, again, it's just sort of keeping your, you know, consistently taking the temperature of what's going on in the professional food world. And so that came from Chad at Tartine, because he wrote a book all about making breads with ancient grains and just how different the texture and the flavor and, you know, the variety of results you can have by using these different grains. I mean, it's just a great time that we have access to all this stuff, right? So that was less from my brain and more from his. So that's kind of what we're doing. I mean, we say we're almost like the host at a cocktail party where we invite our readers and we have access to all these great brains, and we're sort of making the connection and translating those great brains' tips into something that... you know, anyone can understand and then use and apply.
Well, thank you for being our mediator or liaison to all that is good in the world. And you can see more of Julia's work on Yahoo Food. Interact with her on Twitter. You're very good at the social media.
Oh,
maybe
thanks.
Send tips, you know, trends.
Yeah, Google. Holler. At Julia Bainbridge. All one word.
There it is. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Heritage, for, you know, making 200 shows.
Do I see a tear?
No, not at all. It's allergies this time of year. I mean, I'm, again, so thankful to be able to have this opportunity. So if I weren't a robot, I would cry. Thank you again. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Congrats.
Bye. Heritage Foods USA.
for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.